Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to News Hour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. Storm Boris is battering much of central and eastern Europe with gale force winds, torrential rain and widespread flooding. At least four people have lost their lives in Romania and thousands of homes have been flooded. These residents of the village of Slobovia Gonach spoke of the scale of the devastation.
It destroyed everything. I don't have anything left. The beds are filled with mud. The pillows are filled. I have nowhere to sleep.
We don't have food, water, clothes. The neighbor gave me a dress. It killed the dogs, the pigs. It killed all the chickens, all the grains. We have nothing left.
Well, in Slovakia, a state of emergency has been declared in the capital Bratislava. One person is reported to have drowned in Poland, where hundreds of people have been evacuated from their homes. Record wind speeds have been recorded in Austria, with warnings that there is worse to come. While in the Czech Republic, several people are reported missing as around 1,000 firefighters have been deployed to deal with the flooding and falling trees. Let's hear about the situation in two of the countries affected by the flooding. First of all, here's the BBC's Rob Cameron in the Czech capital, Prague.
Here in the capital, in Prague, and it looks and feels pretty bad, but actually the situation here in Prague is perhaps not as critical as elsewhere in the country. Certainly in parts of northeast Moravia, in cities like Ostrava, towns like Opava, Krnov, Český Těšín, there they are evacuating thousands of people, with one town high up in the mountains, Jeseník, has been completely cut off. With the roads and the railway lines completely submerged by the flood waters. So many thousands of people now being evacuated from their homes. Most people are doing so willingly. Unfortunately, some people have refused to leave their homes. And so now we're seeing reports of army and police helicopters circulating those villages and towns along those rivers, trying to save people who refuse to leave their homes and now find themselves stranded in them. The meteorologists say that actually we have seen something like 80% of the precipitation that was due to fall over the country this weekend has now fallen. So perhaps the worst is now behind us here in the Czech Republic. But of course, four people still missing from these floods. They were swept into the river yesterday, late last night, and the authorities don't know whether they have survived. So a dramatic picture here in Prague, but much worse across the country.
That was the BBC's Rob Cameron in Prague. And here's the BBC's Adam Easton in the Polish capital, Warsaw.
Donald Tusk, the Prime Minister of Poland, has been speaking after a crisis management meeting in the southwest of the country, just by the Czech border, actually, where he confirmed the first fatality. A person has drowned here in Poland, and he said 1,600 residents just of the town where he was talking from have been evacuated, and he urged people to cooperate with the emergency services to evacuate their homes, leave their homes if they're called to do so. He also said that they've lost mobile phone coverage, internet coverage, and they're having to rely on landlines. Also, the military are being drafted in. Military helicopters and transporters are being drafted in to help the people in these towns which are flooded. We've seen lots of images on social media being posted, particularly of this town where he was talking from, Quartzcott, and another town, Guhawazi, which the river level has broken over the makeshift sandbag embankment and is now flooded the historic town centre. The mayor of that town has made a dramatic appeal. He said, we're drowning. Please, everybody, evacuate to higher ground.
That was Adam Easton in the Polish capital, Warsaw. And I spoke earlier to Vic Rakuszan. He's the Interior Minister and Deputy Prime Minister of the Czech Republic. What's his assessment of what his country is facing?
Now the situation, it's extremely serious, because we had to provide some evacuation in the cities of Opava, Krnov, Litovel, Český Těšín, Bohumín, and we have also some isolated villages, and the people there are waiting for help of rescue system. So we are really now on the top of the crisis management in the Czech Republic.
So homes have been flooded, homes have been destroyed?
Yes, in some villages and some towns, it's really this type of situation. But I have to say, compared to 2002 and 1997, we are really much better prepared. And also, we really had really good, well-prepared meteorological data, and we have invested as the Czech Republic in anti-flood measures in the last 25 years. So we really hope that the destroyed homes, that we don't want to have the so high numbers as we had the years before.
So what measures have you put in place since the floods of 2002 in order to lessen the consequences?
A lot of anti-flood measures, some barriers in the most affected towns and villages. And what is really very important for all types of crisis, we are starting preparing on time and took all the measures needed in advance. And it's really the biggest difference.
I mean, does Czechia feel that it can contain this crisis itself, or have you maybe reached out to the European Union for help?
At the moment, we are not discussing EU aid. That will be a matter for the next few days, if needed. But now, all firefighters and police are now in the towns and villages, and we have really great cooperation, thank for it, with the regional governments, and so far they are handling it very well, and we can see that our crisis managers also in the region, that they have huge experience, but with a huge commitment of manpower and technology.
I mean, you've spoken about the kind of mitigation measures that have been put in place since 2002. Does this new episode of flooding make you feel as if you need to do more?
We still have some areas in the Czech Republic where the investment to the anti-flood measures is needed. We know it, and the government is prepared to invest. We have a lot of political discussions in the Czech Republic, but by this time, we are really on board also with the opposition, and we don't have this type of political discussion. What we really try to do now is to save the lives of people in the Czech Republic.
That was the Czech Interior Minister and Deputy Prime Minister Vít Rakušan. And let's hear now from Professor Miroslav Torinka in Brno, in the southwest of the Czech Republic. He's with the Institute for Global Change Research of the Czech Academy of Sciences. Firstly, the meteorological explanation for these heavy rains and flooding?
Well, we basically had a slowly moving cold front that turned around, if I put it in very simple terms, and went back over the same area and basically brought an unusual amount of precipitation over the same relatively small region. And that's usually what causes floods in this case, because we get it at multiple catchments and river basins. We are facing both a local flooding, but also we are expecting to have floods downstream as these smaller sort of rivers join together at the lowlands. That's about the rain doesn't have to be so heavy, but because the sheer amount of water that is coming from the catchment, that's what's causing the flooding downstream. So it's a combination of sort of intense rain in many cases over the large areas. So when the river meets the major sort of river, then we have unusually high levels.
And have you been affected where you are?
In Brno itself, we have flooding, especially south of Brno, where two rivers, one of the rivers is relatively well managed with two dams, so they were able to slow down the peak of the flood wave. The other river doesn't have a major dam system, so it's pretty much not a free flowing, but it's relatively more difficult to regulate. So where these rivers meet, then and below, there is a major problem with local evacuations needed.
You used the word unusual earlier on. So you're saying this is unusual because of what?
Well, it's unusual from probably several perspectives. One unusual thing is that, yes, we get floods time to time, but in many areas, these are worse than once in a 100-year flood events. And we had a similar event in 1997, 2002, and now, and we didn't have it over the most of 20th century. So the flooding is sort of looks like returning to Central Europe, and it's probably at the peak compared to the last 500 years, looking at the long-term data with the large Eastern European area, not only the Czechia. The second unusual thing is that it's coming relatively late in the season. Climatologically, we have the most rain in the summer months, June, July, August. September, it's on average much sort of poor in the rainfall. But as the season is getting longer, we face the longer temperatures, then we get the more rain later. But it's unusual in terms of the historical records.
And to what do you attribute that?
Well, the attribution, if it's really only a climate variability or climate change that needs to be done in the future after the event ends. But frankly, from what I said, my personal opinion is that we are increasing the length of the warm season, which makes the floods possible over the longer window. So I would certainly say climate change is not acting against that. Also, in our projections, we see two major changes. One that is very clear, that we have a tendency to lower soil moisture on average, and we have tendency to more droughts. But in the same time, what we see in the models is a possibility of wetter periods, which would indicate a higher potential for the flood. So two different extremes of the same hydrological cycle intensifying. And that's what the projections are showing. And I think we have a pretty severe drought 2015 to 2020. And okay, now we are facing a pretty major flood. So it all sort of fits in the picture that is built through the use of modeling and also interpretation of observation data.
So can you categorically say that this is caused by climate change?
It's rarely the case where you can say it's only the climate change, but I would certainly say climate change has a role in sort of increasing the chance these events happen. Even when the attributions are done, it's always how much more likely or by how many percent more likely the event is. And I would say climate change is certainly helping these events to take place.
That was Professor Miroslav Torinka from the Global Change Research Institute in the Czech Republic. And coming up later in the programme, we'll hear a plea from the mayor of Springfield, Ohio, a town under pressure after Donald Trump's false claim that Haitian immigrants were eating people's pets.
We need help, not hate, in Springfield, Ohio. We need folks to understand the weight of their words and how it can negatively affect communities like ours.
And a reminder of our main news headlines. Israel's prime minister have warned of retaliation against the Houthis in Yemen after they fired a missile that travelled deep into Israeli territory. A boat carrying migrants trying to reach Britain has sunk off the French coast, killing at least 8 people. And one of India's most prominent opposition figures, Arvind Kejriwal, has announced he'll resign as Delhi's chief minister while he fights corruption charges. This is Julian Marshall with News Hour live from the BBC in London. The Emmys, awards handed out to the worldwide television industry, take place later today in Los Angeles, with the TV drama Slow Horses, The Crown and Baby Reindeer among those nominated. The Scottish comedian Richard Gadd is up for 3 awards as the creator of Baby Reindeer, the controversial Netflix series about stalking. Our LA correspondent Emma Vardy managed to charm her way into a decadent pre-show gathering.
Take a 5-star rooftop in Beverly Hills, some famous faces, and you have the BAFTAs tea party. But no one's drinking much tea. It's the Emmys weekend and the champagne is flowing. At the warm-up, everyone's a winner. So who here is going to be walking away with a new piece of metal for their mantelpiece?
They're making moves.
Seems like everybody is.
Mark Duplass, who plays producer Chip Black in The Morning Show, a drama about US TV news, says he doesn't expect to win for Best Supporting Actor, but he hopes the women on the show triumph. 6 actresses are nominated from The Morning Show, including Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston.
She's a unicorn, you know. She is a global icon, and the whole world wants something from her. And that should make her a very closed, difficult to be around person. She's still so open and loving and wonderful, not only just creatively when we're working together, but just personally.
Jackson Lamb, you're in charge of the rejects.
I don't like being called that.
What do you call them?
The rejects.
Spy series Slow Horses, starring Gary Oldman, has 9 nominations, including for Best Drama. Christopher Chung plays one of the misfit spies in the British drama.
And what kind of reaction do you get to Slow Horses now? Because there's been a number of seasons, it's doing so, so well. The characters are so lovable. What do people say to you when you're out and about?
Do you know what? It's again, we've been doing the show for the last 4 years, and it's only now that I feel like it's starting to hit. It's really exciting coming to LA, coming to Hollywood, and having everybody know the show now. We came last year, and it was still kind of bubbling. So it's really satisfying. It's really quite exciting.
Perhaps now is the time.
The royal drama The Crown marks its final series with 18 nominations.
Really manly hands, haven't you? Chiseled jawline.
Should we run away together?
But it's the controversial Netflix series Baby Reindeer that really got people talking this year. The drama about obsessive stalking and sexual abuse became a massive hit when it was released. But the show, which claims to be a true story, is now the subject of a legal battle after audiences try to identify the characters they believe the show was based on. Richard Gadd is Baby Reindeer's star and creator.
When I wrote it, I think I really believed in it, and I believed that it would have success. Did I believe that it would be number one in like 82 countries and have the amount of discussion around it that it has had? Probably not. So it's been a whirlwind, and I'm still kind of catching my feet. I'm still trying to figure it all out.
You're here to celebrate. We wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Is there anything you wish had been done differently?
I can't really answer that right now, because I can't look in the... You can't change the past. The past has happened, and the show has had a phenomenal impact on people. I think there's a lot of, you know, especially in the UK press, there's an incredible focus on the kind of negative, but you can't ignore the positive impact that Baby Reindeer's had. It's been number one in countries like Lebanon and Qatar and places where you never ever thought it would break through. It's had a cross-cultural impact that very few shows have.
The fallout from Baby Reindeer could have repercussions for the TV industry in future in terms of how it deals with drama and involves characters in real life. But right now, they're here to enjoy their success.
That report by Emma Vardy in Los Angeles. Elon Musk, the billionaire behind X, formerly Twitter, SpaceX and Tesla, said this week that he's moving the corporate headquarters of X and SpaceX to Texas from California. The state's rules have long drawn the ire of Mr. Musk, who has endorsed Donald Trump as the next US president, and the new measure attracting his scorn and seemingly prompting his decision to move as a law protecting the privacy of transgender children. So SpaceX will now relocate to Starbase, Texas, and XHQ to the state capital, Austin. I'm joined now by Alex Hannaford, author of an upcoming book, Lost in Austin, The Evolution of an American City. So what's Mr. Musk going to get in Texas that he's not got in California?
Well, no state income tax. That's the reason he's moving there. That's the reason sort of, you know, a lot of these kind of tech firms are attracted to Texas. But I mean, the truth is that the property taxes are pretty exorbitant in Austin. I lived there for 17 years. So, you know, they get you somehow. And I think that when people move there, they're going to realize that actually they're sort of forking out quite a lot of money in property taxes anyway. So maybe it's not all it's cut out to be.
I mean, certainly Austin itself was always seen as a drop of blue in a sea of red, a liberal city in a conservative state. Has that changed?
You know, I think that from my experience, I think that Austin, I live on the East Coast now, but I think Austin and Texas liberals are very, very sort of different breed of people. I think we're, you know, they're kind of socially fairly liberal, but they want to keep a Glock 9mm by their bedside and an AR-15 in a safe in their garage. So, you know, it's a bit different. I think it has changed. I think that Austin, you know, like you said, sort of trades on its credentials as this sort of liberal kind of bastion in deep red Texas. But, you know, you only really have to go sort of 10, 15 minutes outside of Austin to realize you are in Texas. And the other thing, I mean, I lived there with my family for nearly 20 years, and you realize quite quickly that it's all very well sort of saying politically Austin may swing Democrat, but you're still subject to the same Texas laws. So we, you know, we had a kid in school when we lived in Austin. She was, when we left for the Hudson Valley, she was 8 years old, but we were, you know, quite honestly, pretty distraught at the gun culture in Texas. Mm. I mean, that's the other thing. You sort of live in Austin and you're still surrounded by guns. And with a kid in school, I think that hits home.
But statewide, Elon Musk is likely to find the politics more acceptable to him. I mean, are there culture wars in Texas?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Austin, I've got a lot of sort of, you know, friends that kind of sort of, you know, really are sort of staying in Texas and making sure that to sort of fight to turn it. Turn it blue eventually. I think that, you know, there are definitely culture wars in Austin, in Texas. You know, you've got the main cities in Texas, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Austin, that all lean Democrat. You've got Democratic mayors in all those cities. But really, it's such a huge state that it's really, like I said, you only really have to go kind of, sort of 10, 15 minutes outside of those cities to realize you're in sort of the heartland and the politics are very, very different.
And it's said that, well, certainly when it comes to Austin, that it's now as a city unaffordable for the artists and musicians who originally gave the city the vibe that it had.
Yeah, that's the kind of the sort of point I kind of make in my book. That, I mean, you know, there's this kind of saying that the first time you know, anybody goes to Austin is the you know, the greatest the city has ever been, and that's been the case for decades. But I think what fundamentally changed was in, I would say, around about, so we bought our house. I'll give you an example.
Alex, I've got to cut in and just ask you to wrap up very quickly. We're out of time.
No problem. No problem. We bought our house in 2010 for $165,000. By 2014-15, it became unaffordable for most people. House prices
Alex
were sort of astronomical.
Alex Hannaford, author of the upcoming book, Lost in Austin.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. see exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where's the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast, but we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
You're with NewsHour. Afro hair refers to the way in which black people and those of mixed race descent choose to naturally wear their hair, letting it grow out perhaps, or using braiding. But those who do say they often face discrimination at school and at work. And here in the UK, on World Afro Day, campaigners are urging MPs to update equalities legislation to make afro hair what's known as a protected characteristic, which they say could help to end discrimination. I spoke to broadcaster Sarah Jane Crawford, one of 100 black Britons lobbying Parliament, and I asked her about the types of discrimination that people face.
So when it comes to afro hair, there's three main areas where we see discrimination come up. School, where from a very early age, afro hair is deemed as unacceptable. It's not deemed professional. So the second area would be the workplace. So we have stats, and certainly Michelle De Leon, the founder of World Afro Day, has stats to support the fact that, particularly for women, if you're not wearing your hair straightened, then you're less likely to be hired or promoted. And then the third area of discrimination is the fact that because of almost like beauty standards, if you will, and because of the fact that the Eurocentric aesthetic is considered to be more professional, women are putting themselves at risk by trying to straighten their hair. We know that there's statistics around the fact that people who regularly relax their hair, which is using chemical straighteners, are more likely to develop things like reproductive cancers, endometriosis, fibroids, and things like that. So here are the three areas within which we're seeing discrimination: the educational institutions, the workplace, and of course, when it comes to health as well. In particular, black women are at a disadvantage because of the way in which they're trying to do their hair to kind of keep up with the standard that they believe to be deemed professional.
And you're convinced that a lot of this discrimination is a consequence of the way in which black women wear their hair rather than the colour of their skin?
Afro hair is synonymous with African heritage. So I just truly believe that when it comes to being a person of colour, particularly in a country where you are in the minority, there's lots of different ways, some of them obvious and some of them a bit more kind of like microaggressions, where you are told to be more Eurocentric, almost to be more white, basically. It could be in the way that you speak. It could be in the way that you dress. It could be in the way that you wear your hair. There's always different examples of you're not professional if you're too black. And I think that hair is just another extension of that. And that's the reason why it needs to be protected as a characteristic in the Equalities Act.
And what kind of response have you had from those MPs who you have contacted?
You know, really, really positive response. A lot of people may think, hair, this is so woke. What are we doing this for? But it is really important. This is the kind of thing that is linked to as far back as slavery, you know, deeming afro hair to be not as desirable, to be inferior. And unfortunately, it's the reason why people are going to get held back, whether it's school or whether it's the workplace. And it also has a massive psychological impact on people when they feel like the way that they naturally present isn't good enough.
That was broadcaster Sarah Jane Crawford. You're listening to NewsHour, coming to you live from the BBC World Service in London. And we go now to India, where there's been a new and potentially significant development in the case of a junior female doctor who was raped and murdered in Kolkata more than a month ago. Her body was found at the R.G. Carr Medical College in the city, and her death triggered weeks of furious nationwide protests, while junior doctors are continuing to demonstrate outside the regional health headquarters in Kolkata. A suspect was arrested for the rape and killing, and the principal of the college, Sandeep Ghosh, was forced to resign. Now Mr. Ghosh has appeared in court on charges of destroying evidence linked to the rape and murder. He was already in custody, facing separate charges of financial irregularities. An officer in charge of the local police station has also appeared in court. Monideepa Banerjee is a journalist in Kolkata and a former executive editor at NDTV.
The CBI, which is the equivalent of, say, the FBI, is yet to hold a formal sort of press interaction and tell us what the charges exactly are. But what we understand from sources within the CBI is that they have been basically arrested in this case because of conspiracy and attempts to destroy evidence of the crime. Now, specifically, what those are a little hard to come by, but there are some obvious things that happened. One was that there was a destruction of a particular toilet next to the seminar room where the body was found. And it is believed that Dr. Sandeep Ghosh, the former principal of the college, he is the one who ordered it. And there's this other issue of CCTV footage that should have captured what was going on around the seminar room on the night of the 8th of August and on the 9th of August as well, early morning, when the doctor is suspected to have been killed. But we understand that instead of hours of footage from CCTVs, the police has submitted only 27 minutes of footage and claimed to the court that the rest of the footage has glitches and are therefore not available for viewing.
But as you said to me, these details about Sandeep Ghosh destroying evidence are just speculation at the moment.
Well, in the documents filed in court today, the CBI has mentioned sections of the Indian Penal Code, or rather the new version of the Indian Penal Code that we have, citing exactly this: conspiracy to destroy evidence connected to the crime.
But the other details you've given me, the destruction of the toilet, for instance, and CCTV, these are things that people are simply speculating about at the moment.
Well, this is what we as journalists would say CBI sources are telling us. But yes, officially, it is largely speculation in the public space.
Will this add to suspicions that seem to be growing in India that there is more to this case than meets the eye?
I think that suspicion has indeed been growing from day one. And, you know, there seems to be an element of cover-up. When Sandeep Ghosh offered to resign, they transferred him to another equally prestigious medical college in the city, in Calcutta. So there are questions surfacing as to, you know, instead of punishing the gentleman, it seemed that he was being rewarded with another equally important post.
The protests, though, against the murder and rape of this young woman are continuing, are they, but perhaps with less of an intensity they were in the immediate aftermath?
Today, huge protests are once again happening in the streets of the city. The biggest one, perhaps, by the doctors themselves. And there are many others, like teachers of that school are out on the streets marching. Then there another school out in the district, far away from Kolkata. Their alumni, they are marching on the streets. So it's a continuous thing that's going on in the city. Over the last 3 days, the government has tried to initiate talks with the junior doctors to end the deadlock. But somehow, after two very strong attempts to get the talks going, the talks have failed on both occasions. So the deadlock continues. In fact, positions are perhaps hardening, and this 36-day-old siege work by the junior doctors at the moment seems set to continue.
That was Monideepa Banerjee, a freelance journalist in Kolkata. I've also been speaking to Dr. Madhumita Mukhopadhyay, a National Executive Committee member of the Association of Surgeons of India. What does she make of the court appearances today?
Well, the only thing is that the CBI is doing their work. Right from the beginning, when this rape and murder occurred, the students and the junior doctors, they were saying that there's a deep-rooted corruption in that hospital. And what they were trying to say is this corruption and this murder, they are both interlinked. Please try to find out who are the real culprits. And then the whole thing will come out. And so ultimately what happens is like the allegations have been proved true and the principal has been arrested.
I mean, you say that the truth will come out about the real culprits, but somebody has been arrested in connection with this rape and murder.
Right. The arrest is due to tampering of evidence related to the rape and the murder. But there are still culprits at large who are still there and who have not been caught yet. And this is the reason the junior doctors are still agitating. They want the CBI to be a little faster, at least to investigate and nab the culprits.
Could you expand on your use of the word corruption?
What has been in the papers, the newspapers for the last 1 month, corruption of a sex racket, the drug dealings, drug racket, corruption during examinations, corruption during jobs. These are the things which have been coming up every day. The students and the junior doctors have complained against this. It is like a group of people who are into this corruption and the people who are not outside it, they are being threatened.
And you say that this is the reason that doctors continue to protest because they don't feel as if justice has been done yet.
They still feel that there is still more to it. And they feel that if at this point of time they get back to work, this effect of the whole world backing them, this effect will be lost. They want to proceed a bit further and then I'm sure they'll go back to work.
But for the moment, they have defied a deadline set by the Supreme Court for them to return to work.
Right. They have done it. But I think it's a kind of thing that they also want to be heard. They want the Supreme Court to hear their voice. They have got a simple 5 or 6 point demand and they want to talk to the government about it. And they want a clear, transparent exchange of conversation. That's all that they want. If that is done, I think they will surely get back to work. The world is understanding them, but, you know, they need the government to understand them. They need the Supreme Court of India to understand them.
But are the doctors aware of the consequences of their actions by not working, the fact that people have died as a result of a lack of medical treatment?
According to the junior doctors, this is not the actual reason the people have died. They have showed evidences of death rates at the same time in different years. Because the senior doctors are working, it's not that since the juniors are not working, so the hospital is left as it is. The seniors are working overtime. They're doing double the jobs.
I mean, how much public sympathy do you think there is for these continuing protests?
There's a lot of public sympathy. It is just unbelievable. People from different walks of life, people from, say, my daughter's school, the teachers, the mothers of my daughter's friends, they are all into it. Everyone wants this justice for this girl. Even some people who have heard of ex-army men, they are also protesting against this.
And do you feel that the state government, the federal government, is sufficiently engaged with what is happening?
Yeah, they do understand. Actually, the thing is that, you know, there's a lack of communication between the junior doctors and the government. All they want is a clear, recorded communication.
That was Dr. Madhumita Mukhopadhyay, a National Executive Committee member of the Association of Surgeons of India. The Lebanese writer Elias Houri has died in Beirut, aged 76. He was born to a middle-class Greek Orthodox Christian family in Beirut. Mr. Houri joined Fatah, the arm wing of the Palestine Liberation Organization, as a young man and participated in the Lebanese Civil War. He was wounded during the conflict, temporarily losing his eyesight. He went on to write over a dozen novels in Arabic, probably best known for his epic work Gate of the Sun, described as the first true magnum opus of the Palestinian saga. I'm joined now by Fawaz Ghergis, Lebanese-born Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics and Political Science. How significant a political and indeed cultural figure would you say Elias Houri was in the Arab world?
Well, Ilyas Khoury was one of the leading and the most impactful Arab writer, a novelist, a thinker, an Arab public intellectual. He was not just a writer, he was also an activist, as you said. He participated in the Lebanese Civil War as a progressive leftist activist. He fully supported the Arab Spring uprisings in 2010, 2012. The Palestinian tragedy was one of the most important questions that animated the writings of Ilyas Khoury, and of course his opposition to Arab political authoritarianism. I think to him, the Palestinian tragedy was not just about the Palestinians. It was a universal humanist question that affects all human beings. Sadly and tragically, Ilyas Khoury died as a very, he was very embittered in the past few months. I follow his writings in Al-Quds Al-Arabi, a newspaper published in London. And he basically drew a link, an organic link, between what Israel was doing in Gaza and the deepening political authoritarianism, the implosion of the Lebanese society, and the implosion of the Arab political system. He really saw a kind of connection, a link between what the complicity of Arab regimes and the West with Israel's crimes and what's happening, what has been happening in Arab societies in the past 40 or 50 years.
Will he be remembered as a literary or political figure, do you think, or are the two things inseparable in his case?
Well, I don't think you can separate the literary from the political writings of Ilyas Khoury. I think most of his writings focus on questions of exile, on questions of identity, on questions of fragmentation, on questions of basically fragmented societies and identities. And his political writings focus... His political writing focused mainly on the fragmentation and the implosion of the Arab political system.
Professor Lukmeni, thanks. That was Fawaz Gergis, Lebanese-born professor of international relations at the London School of Economics and Political Science, reflecting there on the life of the Lebanese writer Ilyas Khoury, who's died in Beirut, aged 76. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. One of the most startling phrases to come out of last week's presidential debates between Vice President Kamala Harris and Donald Trump was the former president's accusation that immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, were eating cats and dogs. City officials were quick to deny it, but President Trump and his running mate, J.D. Vance, have not corrected the claim, and there's been a major and dangerous fallout in the blue-collar town of 60,000 people. On Friday, three schools were evacuated due to bomb threats. At least one of the threats made disparaging comments about Haitians, according to Springfield Mayor Rob Brew. My colleague, Lise Doucette, asked him what the past week had been like.
All the attention we've gotten, the negative attention, has been a concern, for sure. But we are a beautiful community and a resilient community. And that's one of the things we want to make sure people understand that are looking in, especially from across the sea, that we are a vibrant community. We've had an economic upturn. It's just disheartening to have some of this negative press and some of these false rumors spread about us.
What are the incidents or threats that worry you the most?
Well, I mean, any time that there's hate and involved with, you know, there's been bomb threats to our community in the last couple of days. We've had schools closed down, city buildings closed down. We've had to check different properties with email threats that we're receiving.
And President Trump is now saying that he will carry out large deportations. Does that intensify the anxiety?
I definitely think that does increase the anxiety. We need help, not hate, in Springfield, Ohio. So we need folks to understand that, especially those that have the national stage, that have a microphone that's being listened to around the world, that they need to understand the weight of their words and how it can negatively affect communities like ours.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the Haitian community in Springfield.
over the last 3 years, we've definitely had a population increase, a rapid population increase of about 25% to our population over the last 3 years. And that will strain any infrastructure of any community, city. We've definitely experienced a strain. There's definitely been a culture clash. It's been difficult driving customs. So we've definitely seen an uptick of reckless operation on our roads.
Is that why President Trump's comment in the debate about eating pets landed?
Well, I want to first say that that is a rumor that is absolutely, it's a rumor and it's false. You know, people's pets are safe in Springfield, Ohio. We reached out to the J.D. Vance campaign and let them know that we do not have any evidence that that has happened. And we've made it known. I've made it known on multiple interviews that these are just absolutely not true.
But they seem to be repeating them. They're not backing away at all.
I noticed that. That doesn't help Springfield, Ohio. That doesn't help us. We are a hardworking community. We are a legacy city in the state of Ohio. We are a community that comes together to collaborate and work together to solve problems. And like I said, we need help, not hate. We need help.
You've mentioned some of the negative things which are happening, but has there been any positive ones that, for example, members of the community who have welcomed the Haitians?
We have definitely seen employers have embraced some of the Haitian immigrants that are here. They're working hard. They are pretty peaceable. You know, we don't really have an uptick in crime at all. You know, the only thing we have seen is the traffic concern. We are in the growing pains of this. So they're peaceable, but it's a stress and strain on the infrastructure.
And you have no doubt in your mind that their presence is a positive one. It hasn't caused you to think again about whether it was the right move to, as you say, add 25% so quickly?
We did not have anything to do with this increase. So it has been, because of how it was done and how quickly it was done, it's been just, it's been difficult. So it would have been nice if it was a slower increase so we could acclimate and have a better ability to handle the influx of folks in town.
President Trump has said he might visit Springfield. Would you welcome him?
That would be a very difficult visit. It would tax our infrastructure even more right now. We've already had to spend a lot of finances on overtime and just extra security based on the attention and the negative attention we receive. So I think it would be very difficult to receive either candidate in Springfield right now.
Deputy Mayor of Springfield, Ohio, Rob Rue. Well, following Mr. Trump's controversial and debunked remarks, social media has been flooded with amusing memes and reactions. Digital creators have showcased their skills as they come up with not just memes, but parody songs like this one called Eating the Cats.
They're eating the dogs. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
People of Springfield, please don't eat my cats. Why would you do that? Eat something else.
Well, that was by the musician David Scott, also known as the Kiffinus, surfer slang for cool, who's based in Cape Town, South Africa. He's on the line now. Do you follow US politics closely, or did you come across these Trump remarks online?
Hi, Julian. Thanks for having me, and thanks to your listeners. I haven't been following that closely, but back in 2020, sort of during COVID, I used to make political satire about politicians, and these songs often, you know, divided opinion and further polarized people. And so I've actually moved away from that towards the end of 2021, and I actually started remixing videos of cats and dogs and people around the world. So my aim with this particular song is to bring levity to a heated topic and, you know, unite people around a common cause. And in this case, the cause is to raise money for the animals in Ohio. So any money that we make from the song on YouTube or Spotify is going to be donated to the SPCA, in Springfield, Ohio.
I mean, you speak about levity, David, but in a way, do you not feel that's kind of undermining the gravity of what Mr. Trump said? Or do you think it was just so ridiculous?
I just saw the absurdity and the ridiculousness of the comment, and it just so happened to make a humorous song. I'm not taking away from, you know, the seriousness of the situation, and I think there is something to be said about using humor and satire to highlight the questionable decisions or statements of authority figures. But I don't think that's my role. I think I ultimately believe that my role in society is to use my talents, my God-given talent, which is music, to just bring joy and light. And if that means taking a clip of Donald Trump saying a ridiculous thing, I think I'm going to do that.
What's been the feedback from maybe US Democrats, US Republicans? I must ask you to be brief.
Well, I think everyone loves music. Everyone loves dogs and cats, so there's that. And I think the words that Trump used just so happened to be hilarious and, you know, made for a great song, like I said. But even people who dislike Trump have been telling me that the song is an earworm and they can't get it out their heads. And I think it's great. You know, Democrats think that I'm making fun. The Republicans think it's a great song. And that's,
I've got to end it there. South African musician David Scott, also known as the Kipnis, ending this edition of NewsHour.
Es ist kein Geheimnis, dass geistige und körperliche Gesundheit Hand in Hand gehen. Wir alle streben nach einer guten Work-Life-Balance. Und der Zugang zu den besten Fitness- und Wellness-Einrichtungen, Sportarten und Geräten ist die ultimative Motivation. Als einer der führenden Anbieter von Firmenfitness in Deutschland weiß Hansefit um die Vorteile für Arbeitgeber und Arbeitnehmer. Mit über 8.500 Partnern, die über 50 verschiedene Sportarten anbieten, von Fitness- und Yoga-Studio, Schwimmbädern und Boulderhallen bis hin zu Wellness-Tempeln, bietet Hansefit jedem etwas. Für mehr Informationen besuche hansefit.de und empfiehl im Mitgliederbereich deinen Arbeitgeber.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.